Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Jane Green, the 17-time New York Times bestselling author, and her latest novel is The Friends We Keep. Jane, as I read this book, I kept thinking back to a little song I remember singing at my kindergarten graduation, and the lyrics, I've never forgot them, it said, make new friends and keep the old, one is silver and the other is gold. Does that sort of encapsulate the overall theme of this book?
Oh, that's so lovely. I've never heard that before. It really does. I mean, I found myself thinking so much about the friendships that we make when we're young, and particularly actually the friendships we make at university, school and university, and how we go through the rest of our lives making friends, and those friendships are wonderful, but there is something magical about the friendships we make when we're young, before we decide who we want to be, before we build the constructs that show the world the kind of adult we are. And they are the people that I think in many ways know us best, because they know the real us. And I really wanted to look at friends who vowed that they would be friends forever, but of course life gets in the way and they end up losing touch and becoming estranged, and 30 years goes by, and when they find each other again at their 30th reunion, within seconds, it's as if no time has passed, and they realize that they don't want to live the second part of their lives without each other, and they end up living together again. But in fact, there is a secret from the past that threatens to derail everything. So that is the plot. I have just given away the story of The Friends We Keep.
Well, what is it that draws Evie and Maggie together in the first place?
I think it's really, you know, on the surface, they all look like the perfect popular people, the freshmen that everybody would want to be friends with. But in fact, in they're all misfits in their own way. Evie is half American, half Jamaican. She's a former child actress whose mother had her on diet so she could get work, whose weight has always been an issue for her. And she's very beautiful, but she doesn't feel it. She's not aware of it. She is riddled with insecurity. And then you have Topher, who discovers at the end of his university, his senior year, that he is gay, and he also feels like something of a misfit, doesn't quite belong. And then Maggie, who has always belonged, is from this very upper crust country background, and she finds it very hard to fit in, because as soon as she opens her mouth and she sounds very posh and posher than the rest of the people there, they immediately mock her and make fun of her, and so the three of them are kind of drawn to each other because they recognize in each other that they don't quite fit in.
Well, they meet Topher together, Evie and Maggie do. Do you think that they would have been friends with Topher independently had the three not been together at the same time when that meeting happened?
That's a really interesting question. I believe that Evie and Topher would have been friends, but I don't know that Maggie and Topher would have naturally gravitated towards each other. And they actually meet, they go furniture, Maggie and Evie are roommates, they meet each other, and they room together, and Maggie takes Evie off shopping for accessories for their room to make it look nicer, and when they walk into this big furniture store, they think it's a mannequin lying on a bed at first, but in fact it is Topher, this rather glamorous man from Greenwich, Connecticut, and he's larger than life, and he's just lying on one of the beds in a room set in a furniture store reading, because it's comfortable and lovely and he needs to be in lovely surroundings. So I did love the way they met, but you're quite right. I'm not so sure that Maggie and Topher would have been a natural fit had Evie not been with them.
The book opens in the 1980s of the UK. I remember the 80s in the US. There was a very distinctive feel to it, looking back. The music, the movies, the economy, the Cold War, all that stuff. Did the 80s in the UK have a distinctive feel in retrospect?
Yes, I think it did. I wonder if perhaps it was the last decade to have a distinctive feel. I do often find myself thinking, gosh, what were the 90s? And what were the, I'm not even sure what you call them, the noughties, the first decade in, after the year 2000? I'm not sure that there was a distinctive look or I mean, politically, it's easy to think about what was going on politically, but it didn't define our culture in the way that it did in decades before. And I don't know whether that's because of the internet and because we're all communicating, and I'm not sure why it's changed, but I do believe that the 80s, for me at least, the 80s was the last decade that was really defined.
What defines it for you? What do you remember that makes it stand out
well,
to you?
Of course, you know, as an 18-year-old, it was less politics and much more hairstyles, the terrible mullets, the terrible perms, the music, and I think it was different music in England, but the music, I can still, you know, every now and then I'll hear a song from the 80s, from that time in my life, and it will sweep me back. And it's music that I don't hear so often today, although I have to say my son is, he's a theater kid, he's in high school, he's a junior, and he is doing a summer show which is called Take Me Back to the 80s, and so in my house is now filled with 80s music. Whenever I walk in, he's playing something from the 80s. So I'm being swept back there on a regular basis.
Other than in the Facebook sense, I wouldn't consider myself friends with anyone I went to college with. Is it when you meet someone at a particularly damaged time in your life, is that what makes such a long-lasting friendship, because you needed them at that particular time and they know so much about you?
So I think that it's more that it's a time in your life before you become an adult and before your first job and before you have responsibilities, and it's the last time in your life where you really have a sense of freedom and you can really be who you are. You don't have to step into the adult world. So I think that there's a freedom that comes with those friendships. What's interesting is, even if you do lose touch, and certainly I'm not in regular touch. I mean, I live over here and all of my college friends live in America. But every now and then we will get together, and I will say there is a magic, and there is something that happens where it really does feel as if no time has gone by, and there is a joyous quality to those relationships that I don't have in quite the same way in my adult friendships.
I'm chatting with Jane Green. Her new novel is The Friends We Keep. It is now available everywhere. Go pick up a copy. Jane, when we talk about these friendships that have lasted this long, I think back to the guy friendships that I had. I wasn't platonic friends with very many females, but with guys, we would do things together. We'd go out, have drinks, we'd smoke, you know, we'd smoke cigars, go golfing, things like that. As you get older, you know, you've got kids, life gets in the way and all that stuff, and so the whole nature of your friendship changes. And does it seem like everybody's nature of their friendship changes at the same time as life moves on to keep those friendships viable?
Well, I think the short answer to that is yes. And actually, it's making me think that one of the real inspirations behind the novel was my realization that as a 51-year-old woman living in the suburbs in Connecticut with children who are almost out of the home, my life is much more isolated than I ever anticipated. And it's not that I don't have friends, it's not that I'm not busy, but I find that I am much lonelier than I ever expected to be. And when I speak to women of the same age, and I think some men as well, so many of us are feeling that way, and we're not quite sure why. And I think that technology has an enormous part to play in it. We're all hiding behind our screens. We've forgotten how to connect. And certainly, nobody I know phones anymore. We all text, and heaven forbid my phone should ring. I look at it in horror, thinking, why can't you text me like a normal person? But of course, the result of that is that we're all in our houses feeling lonely. And I think because we remember what it was like before technology. We remember what it was like to go out golfing with a friend and or phone a girlfriend on a Saturday morning and sit and chat for 2 hours. I think that we are the generation that really has to make the effort and reach out, because this isolation is growing. We're living in a culture that is becoming more and more isolated, and I'm starting to make the kind of effort that I haven't made in years, where rather than text people, I phone them. Of course, no one picks up, but I'm working on them, and I'm just trying to invest more in our friendships. We get so caught up in our lives, in our kids, and all of a sudden our kids leave, and we realize that we haven't put the effort into our friendships that we might have done.
Well, how much of your isolationism, though, is attributable to the fact that you're a novelist? Because you spend a lot of time alone just by virtue of your trade.
Well, I do and I don't, and you're quite right. I'm definitely an introvert, but I'm also an introvert that loves people. And I need to be in and of the world in order to have something to write about. And certainly, you know, when I speak to my friends who are not novelists, they are going through something very similar. So I think it may also be the curse of middle age.
I think readers take for granted authors such as yourself who consistently write bestsellers. They're always waiting for the next one. You know, I'm sure people ask all the time, so what are you working on next? But there's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that the reader never sees that goes into each book, especially the friends we keep, right?
Yeah, a girlfriend of mine helped me out with some marketing a couple of years ago, and she helped me out for about a month, and she turned to me when the month was up, and she said, oh my goodness, I had no idea how hard you work. She said, I always thought you had this incredibly easy life where you just wrote for a few hours a day, and then, I don't know what she thought I was doing, lounging on a sofa eating chocolates perhaps, but she had no idea of the blood, sweat, and tears that goes in. And being a novelist today is very different from being a novelist 20 years ago, my first book was published 23 years ago, and the whole landscape has changed. And I will say that when I first started, it was easy, and it was rather romantic and rather glorious. And I had big teams of marketing and PR people who did everything, and my only job was to write. But now my job is to write and to run all my social media campaigns, because you can't possibly, no publisher is going to be interested in you if you don't have a sizable following on Instagram or Facebook or Twitter, you know, whichever one you choose. It is constantly doing all of my own marketing and making sure that I reach out to the influencers and the bloggers. It is writing short stories and novellas and guest pieces, and it's constant. And that's as well as you know, writing and living enough of a life in order to have something to write about.
So how did it come to be? I mean, authors aren't unionized, so there wasn't a union rep that could come in and say, no, we're not doing this. We're here to write, and that's all. So was it simply, was there just a seismic shift at one point that made this all happen?
It's social media. It is a seismic shift. And every author that I speak to is, we are all going through the same thing. So there really aren't enough hours in the day, you know, between writing, raising a family, and all of the work that social media requires. It's really tiring. Having said that, I wouldn't change my life. I know there are people who have other people run their social media accounts, but I think that readers, your loyal readers, can always tell. They can tell when it's not you.
I wanted to ask you this. When you Google your name, the word beach read always comes up. For me, that term always has such a fluffy-sounding connotation to it, and your books are quite the opposite. Do you embrace that beach read characterization, or is that a marketing thing?
Well, it's a marketing thing, and it's become... It's become big in the last few years, and you know, publishing is suffering so much right now, and nobody knows quite what to do, and nothing is selling in the way that it used to, and people aren't reading in the way that they used to, and so publishers will leap onto anything that seems like it would be successful, and so excuse me, books that are perceived as beach reads are still have the chance to be a big summer blockbuster. And so even when, and I have many friends who have written very serious books dealing with issues like Alzheimer's and cancer, and they find that their covers have girls in bikinis or, you know, children in swimming pools, and they market everything as a beach read. Now, I will also say that I think the term beach read is frankly anything that you enjoy reading on a beach. It doesn't have to be a pejorative. A beach read, I think, is anything that's compelling and a story that you can lose yourself in.
Now, Lin-Manuel Miranda said that he read Ron Chernow's Hamilton book on the beach, so I guess anything can qualify.
Well, and that was not an easy book to read.
Not at all. So, yeah. All right. I know we're short on time. The book is The Friends We Keep. Jane Green is the author. This is destined to be another New York Times bestseller. Jane, just fantastic time talking to you. Thanks for doing this interview, and thanks for putting out a book that we can all enjoy this summer.
Oh, thank you. It's so lovely to talk to you. Thank you.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.